come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, when our guest is the incredible Santiago Vaquera Vázquez, whose new book,
One Day All. I'll tell you the things I've seen.
Just came out. And we have a bio. What do we know about this crazy guy in the studio today?
Right.
He is in the studio, which is awesome.
Absolutely, he is. I know. That's a rare treat. So thank you for being here, Santiago. He's also the author of Algún Día Te Cuento Las Cosas Que He Visto and Luego de Silencio. But he's also an assistant professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese nearby at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque.
And this is his first English language book. It's a collection of stories, although I would argue that there is a lot of memoir-esque aspects to this narrative. And it's a fantastic book.
It is, you know, and to some of us, he seems like a new name because he's kind of new on the radar. However, Santiago has been publishing in Latin America and Spain and places all across the world in Spanish for the most part for many years. And so this is his first book here.
Yes.
And now he's on the Saguaro circuit doing the doing the book tour, right?
yep, exactly.
Well, thanks for coming in and for sitting in the studio. Let's start with a really basic question. You've been publishing in Spanish, and you're pretty well known in the literary Spanish language community. You travel a lot to Spain and to Mexico, and you go to all these conferences. But you wrote a book in English. Why, and what was it like?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, so I'll try to keep it short. The reality is that when I started writing in Spanish, I wanted to follow in the footsteps of an earlier generation of Chicano writers, right from the 1960s and 1970s, who had written in Spanish.
Right.
People like Hinojosa, Tomas Rivera, Miguel Mendez, right, Alejandro Morales. Mm. And they were writers who I think are really important for those who came later, right? So like Cisneros, Sánchez Cisneros, or Ana Castillo. And so it is my that became sort of like the number one question that I've been asked in interviews is, you know, you grew up in the United States, but why do you write in Spanish?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's part of my response is precisely that, is that I think it's necessary to remember that we have a whole body of work that's written originally in Spanish. And so switching over to English was one of these things that I'd never really considered, at least this early. I thought maybe later on, after I'd published a few more things in Spanish, because, you know, like I said, I think it's very important to remember the work of our writers who came before us, who used Spanish as a creative language, and I think that's something that's still necessary to be used.
Well, you're a pretty good friend with the fiction writer Junot Díaz. As you know, as we all know, one of the things that Junot Díaz did is he stopped italicizing Spanish.
Right.
And everyone thought it was a radical move, you know, because he was basically asserting the idea that Spanish is not, like I said earlier, a foreign language. It isn't. I mean, we go back and forth, especially, you know, not only lives of Chicanos, but here on the border. Did you make a conscious choice not to other the Spanish language in this book?
Yes. In fact, one of the things when I publish in Spanish and I also drop in some English is that I work with editors to make sure that the English is not italicized, because as I always tell them, I don't speak in italics.
nice.
And so they never always listen to me. Like the book that I published last year, Luego el Silencio, when the first versions came out, they were all the English was italicized, and I commented to the editor, I think it's very important that we recognize the fact that those of us who are bilingual, right, we don't think in terms of italics. But unfortunately, the editor forgot to make that change. And so when it came to putting this book together, the very first draft that came back, they'd done the same thing with the Spanish, and I went back to my main editor at the press and said, listen, I think it's very important for me not to have the Spanish italicized. There are some words in italics, right? For example, so I use some Turkish in the book.
Right.
So that is not a language that I speak.
Right. You do speak in italics when it comes to Turkish.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So I think it is very important, right? And then, but you look at people like Norma Cantú, right? I mean, Canicula is really great because she does the same thing. There's no italics at all in the way that the book flows between Spanish and English.
Right.
So I think it's very important for us as writers who live sort of in between worlds that we tell the editors to you know remind them that we don't speak right sort of in italics.
Yeah. And the only problem might be when there's certain words like you say, last night for dinner I had mole.
See,
as opposed to mole.
Yeah, exactly.
Mole. It depends on what country you're in.
Right.
But you know, in Santiago, you know, one of the things is in the presentations that you've done, you know, with your previous works, which were in Spanish. Mm-hmm. You know, what's been the reception like, or how's that experience been like for you doing this? I guess we call it a crossover. Like Selena, yeah. You know, crossover.
Yeah.
Now, how's the, you know, the presentation, how the audience been receiving it now? How's that work for you?
Well, this is actually the beginning, right? So I haven't, I've had very few experiences reading in English. I did do an event, and actually I think maybe going back to the earlier question about making the transition, I started translating my own work when I was invited to do a thing at the Poetry Foundation a couple of years ago in Chicago. And I was with two other Mexican writers, and we were asked to read a fragment of a poem that we thought was important for us, and as well as some of our own work. And so I translated a couple of short stories, and then I read a fragment of a piece by Tino Villanueva, which I think is just an amazing poet.
Right.
And out of that, I started thinking more in terms of, well, maybe I should start translating my work and sending it out. So so far the reaction has been interesting, right? In regards to my work being published, because a lot of it is, you know, I write about the border. I write about people who find themselves in these intermediate places.
Right.
And that I think that's resonated in Latin America when I read my work. The very first question that always comes up is, wow, this is a Chicano who's writing in Spanish.
Right.
That's a really good point, right? Because one of the things, as I've said in the past, is when I first started writing in Spanish, I wanted to try to write, you know, write correctamente, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that's not going to happen because my Spanish is inflected by my family from northern Mexico, right?
Mm.
So it is a Mexicano Spanish, but because of the fact that I've also lived in Spain, my Spanish also has a lot of these weird little Spanish things, like I say vale a lot, and so I found that, you know, that in the end the languages that we carry will always give us away, right?
Mm.
So when I write in Spanish, I can't hide the fact that I'm my Spanish is already sort of, it's not regionally specific anymore.
The languages we carry will always give us away. Right. That's a nice
yeah.
quote.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to write that down. I'll quote you sometime. We have Santiago Vaquero Vasquez in the studio, and we're talking about his new book, just came out, called One Day I'll Tell You the Things I've Seen. Santiago, you and I are friends. We've known each other for at least a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this book used to have a different title. Can you talk about that original title and this title and how it reflects the content of the book?
Right. Yeah. The book was originally titled Snapshots of People I've Known, which the idea was influenced, I have to confess, by Norma Cantú's Canicula, which I think is a fantastic book telling stories but through photographs.
Mm-hmm.
I have a story in this particular collection that is this idea of this person who wanders and who travels and who carries snapshots. And when I was putting together the collection, I was thinking in terms of that, right? That these are snapshots of travel and wandering and
right.
and being placed and placeless. And that was the original title. And when the press comes back, and it happens a lot, I guess, is that they suggest different titles. And another one of the stories is One Day I'll Tell You the Things I've Seen. And they felt it worked better for the collection. And I hope they're right. I think they're right.
I think I like the title. It's very intriguing. In fact, if you could see the cover, Google this. it's a picture of a man and woman who probably aren't together, looking off. It looks like a boat. Can you tell us how this became the cover?
Yeah. So I was traveling back home. I was in Ankara, and I was at a conference and I took a
train in Turkey, where you go a lot.
Yeah. My friends now say that that's my third home. My second home is Mexico.
I would say that you are actually a Turkey. You go so much.
Yeah. So I was on the ferry in Istanbul going back from the Asian shore to the European side, and I was taking photographs. And there was this woman standing there on the boat who I really liked her bag, and I liked the bag, mm-hmm. and I liked the red coat, and there was just the look, right? It was a cold night. It was late fall. We were crossing the Bosphorus in the evening, and so I took a number of photographs of people, and when it came time to choose a cover, I suggested to the press. I said, well, you know, why don't you take a look at some of these photos? Because in many ways, the my stories are always begin as an image that I've seen, and so I suggested a number of photographs, and they chose this one.
This is really provocative.
Yeah. I noticed then on your bio you are self-described border crosser, and it's true. And you know that's the idea in this book. I mean, this book has so much range in terms of place. And you yourself are originally from the Northern California area, mm-hmm. and so the books, the stories start there, but then they just span across the globe, really. Mm-hmm. And so, and in fact, what I really love too is that the book itself opens up with a sort of border crossing, mm-hmm. and it ends, and so you have you bookend it that way. It's fantastic. So tell us a little bit about, you know, maybe how your travels have influenced this book, the stories in the book.
Well, I am one of the things that I'm always doing when I travel is I try to observe what's happening, and as I said earlier, my stories sort of always come out because of a photograph or an image that I've seen, mm-hmm. right? So this morning, a collection of balloons flying up in the sky, and Daniel and I talking about whether it's a jetpack or it's balloons.
We thought it was some guy on a jetpack.
Drone, right? Oh, wow. And these kinds of things. And I just thought, wow, that's actually a really cool image, and that could be something that could eventually be worked into a
It ended up being just a whole bunch of balloons that somebody let go, and it's kind of think, well, some right now there's some kid crying somewhere.
Right. And there's a poetry in that I think that I find fascinating. And so when I travel, I think in terms of looking at these what I call these random images of the day. And the stories come out of that, out of the fragments of the other day. I wanted to write stories that on the surface, and maybe they are, right? But on the surface are very sort of cotidiano, everyday, daily, almost banal things. And I think in terms of, well, how can we inject this image with something else?
You know, one of the things that I understand about traveling is that when you go to a foreign place, mm-hmm. the banal becomes amazing.
Yeah.
Because any type of just, you know, random image becomes amazing because you're outside of your, you know, your comfortable environment.
Right.
And I'm wondering if all that travel, if it helps you to explore the amazing no matter where you're at.
I think so. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. I mean, when we travel and we find ourselves in a new situation, or even in a situation that in some ways is familiar if we travel to the same place often, it does sort of attune you to looking at objects or things that you see on the street or out and about, and it makes you think, it triggers you to sort of a magic, right? That it can exist in other places. And this is not to say that it's just because I travel internationally a lot, but also when I'm just around town, again going back to the balloons this morning. One of the reasons why I love living in Albuquerque is because it's so weird. I see things in the street, and I think to myself, "Wow, that is actually amazing." Which just sort of shows you by sort of the beauty and the magic of everyday life. And everyday life that is in many ways is sort of very normal and.
Right. It kind of goes back to what we had talked about in the previous show. I think it was with Brian Turner. We talked about traveling, how traveling, you know, we end up having to use sort of different tools, right, in terms of awareness. And so then we bring that home after we've traveled and we see our same neighborhoods differently even.
Right.
Sort of different things are illuminated, right?
I mean, So it's exactly. That's exactly it. Right.
You know, reading this book, one day I'll tell you the things I've seen. it's the language is really intimate. It's as if you're talking to somebody. Like, and I'll quote something exact. I'm going to tell you a story. You say as a transition into, I guess, a exposition, a flashback, whatever you want. But I love that language, and it just seems so intimate. Did you consciously write this as if you were writing to a buddy or writing to somebody that you're very close to? Because it really does feel like you're talking to me.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a great observation. I hadn't really thought about it, but I love the act of storytelling.
Right.
And I think that that stories are a way of bringing together communities. I've said in another context that when we tell stories, we are knitting ourselves together into a larger whole.
I like that.
And so, I think about when I was a child in my summers in Mexicali at my grandmother's house, and how in the evenings it was always they would sit around, my tías and my tíos and my grandmother would sit around talking about the people who had left, right? So they either because they died or because they'd crossed the border and we never heard from them again. And in that act of storytelling, they were bringing them back into the present.
And you know, that kind of harkens back to the beginning of your book where the narrator is at the border. This is the first story in the book. He's at the border. The border guard asks him, what are you bringing from Mexico? And he replies,
Nothing but my dead.
Right. And so that carries throughout the rest of the book, right? That you're carrying sort of the sort of ancestral past with you.
Yeah. And I think it's important. And one of the reasons why I travel is I like to listen to stories too.
Mm-hmm. You know, this book in many ways is about travel. You know, people think I travel a lot, but compared to you, I'm a stay-at-home soccer mom.
I don't know about that.
I don't know, bro.
You do. You travel quite a bit. Yeah. But
we met in Spain.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, come on, you guys meet up on the opposite side of the world, you know?
That's true. The first time we met is in Spain, and boy, did we have a night, didn't we?
More than one, I think.
Yeah.
And a train ride.
I think we got back started our way back to our hotels at about 4 in the morning. But anyway. In many ways, this book, you know, even though it's about travel, it's really about the people that you've met along the way. Even people here like Carmen, whose last name you don't remember, Clara, who gave you nightmares, your best friend Lupe, who turned out to be a Tecato.
Yeah.
You know, what is the connection between these people and the meaning of the book, I guess?
It's all about the story. It's all about our community, right? I mean, it's for me, all of these characters I've known either personally or heard their stories being told. Like the character of Lupe, for example, is in a part of a larger sort of arc about the missing brother Todd.
Todd Rodriguez, isn't it?
Yeah,
Rodriguez.
Their parents gave him an Anglo name so he could fit in, but they forgot to change his last name.
I can totally relate to that. I can identify with that.
But it's true, right? I mean, so we have this moment in our history, right, when our parents try to make our lives easier, but they don't realize it, right? I mean, I was given the name Santiago, and I'm growing up in Northern California. Right. And in the late 1960s and early 70s, when I was the only Santiago I ever met, so I love that line in The House on Mango Street, right? When the narrator is talking about her name and she says, you know, in English my name means hope, in Spanish it means too many letters. And Santiago was like that, right? As a child, so my family calls me Jimmy.
Jimmy?
Really?
That's it. I'm going to start calling you Jimmy.
That's it, Jimmy.
Jimmy Santiago Baca. Yeah, there's some incredibly painful moments in this book as well. The depiction of what your father did to your mother, walking into that room and seeing that. I'm not going to say what it is. I think people should read the book. So when you were a young man, and I think it was in high school or junior high, maybe it was even in elementary, you had to see the school psychologist, Mrs. Parsons. Well, I guess not a psychologist, but an analyst.
Right.
And she would pull photos and show them to you and say, tell a story. And to me, that just seems like one of the metaphorical anchors in this whole book, because you're still kind of doing that. You take pictures a lot and you tell stories a lot.
Yeah.
So tell us about that experience.
Yeah.
Well, even though, you know, that is fiction. My friends always tell me, it isn't. It's real. I remember that. there was a moment.
I understand.
Yeah, there was a moment when it's true, right? I mean,
yeah, I said your father. I keep forgetting it's fiction. It's so realistic.
You never
I forget.
But I do remember that there was a moment when I did have to see a school therapist when I was in middle school, and there were the photographs of these families, and so you're supposed to sort of you were expected to talk about what's going on in the photos, and that has always stayed with me. Right, there's a part of, you know, so like. Well, I mean, I've told you a bit about my life, right? When I was younger, my sister had cancer, and mm-hmm. and there was a period in my life where we were uprooted, and this brought about having to see a school therapist because, mm-hmm. you know, anybody who has to change schools three times and is separated from their family.
Right.
I think that may be also where I got this sort of love for telling stories and listening to stories.
Right. And you're still kind of doing it now.
Yeah. Yeah,
your photos are amazing, and you take a lot of photos.
Yeah,
today how many did he take? Tim?
We
had breakfast. I think he took photos of my taco.
Yeah, I need to remember everything.
No, yeah. You know, and even though the language in here is, as Daniel pointed out, you know, very sort of intimate and almost mm-hmm. casual. You get a casual sense that you're having a conversation with a friend about the stories, about the things that you've seen. Mm-hmm. The language is so tight. I felt like the stories were just worked. And because it was clean, you know, and I could just it was just fantastic read. I'm just curious, you know, and even for some of my students as well, how long have you been working on these stories?
Well, thanks for that. Thanks for that mm-hmm. observation. I think I'm glad you feel that way. Right. One of the things about translating myself that I discovered is, you know, after so many years of working in Spanish, there's a literary language that I have. And then switching it over into English has been kind of a trip because I realized that without being conscious of it, I've ended up becoming a writer who writes creatively in Spanish, but who writes academically in English,
oh, wow.
and those are two different grammars.
Right. Yeah.
Hmm. So coming over to write creatively in English has been a struggle. And so it took me a while to work on these stories, and many of them are originally written in Spanish, so they're self-translated,
right.
And a number of them, like Snapshots of People I've Known, is originally written in English. That was one of the first stories that I wrote entirely in English, and it's been tough, right? Been thinking in terms of how to switch from one language to another.
Right.
The other day, a friend made an observation because he's read the stories in both versions, and he mm-hmm. says, you know, there's something interesting about your English that I almost like them better in English. I like them in Spanish, but there's another sort of rhythm that you're working on in English.
Mm. Right, right.
Wow. That I find that I'm still thinking about. Right. And so
sure,
that you mentioned
sure.
that is so working is I do edit a lot. In
right.
fact, many of these stories
shows,
were much
yeah.
longer, and I cut.
Yeah. Well, I teach in a bilingual MFA, and this semester I'm teaching a class with six Latin Americans, six mm-hmm. North Americans, writing in their respective languages. And sometimes a Latin American will write something in English,
yeah.
although somebody who writes in English rarely tries to write mm-hmm. in Spanish. And you could kind of sense the kind of stilted quality of the attempt.
Right.
But in this, when I read this, I would have never guessed that your books are in Spanish, you know, because it's just, I mean, you are a native speaker.
Well, thanks.
It's like, who said that? Somebody on the show, the one who read at Obama's inauguration.
Richard Blanco?
Blanco. When he was on the show, we were talking about his latest memoir, and he says, people always ask me, what's my first language? And he says, English and Spanish.
Right.
I don't have a first language.
Right.
And that seems to be the same with you.
Yeah, response, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, it is my first language was English and Spanish, right? That's how I grew up, right? English at school, speaking Spanish at home with my parents, and then traveling, spending my summers in Mexicali with my my abuela. So it was
right.
It's always been that mix, and that was the other. Like, when I'm asked a question, why do you write in Spanish? My response is, well, why not? I mean, I carry two tongues, oh, yeah. in my mm-hmm. mouth. Mm-hmm. Why not
I carry
use
two tongues in my mouth. Another quotable quote.
That's it. We should have a wall of quotable quotes.
You know, let me ask you another question about traveling, because like I said, folks, you don't know how much this guy travels. He's in El Paso right now. On Sunday, yeah. he's going to Mexico City. Then he's going to Merida. Then he's going back to Albuquerque. And then he's going to Turkey again.
Yeah.
And that's just, what, a couple of months yeah. in your oh. life. when I first started traveling, internet was not as efficient as it was. We didn't have smartphones.
Right.
And so whenever I needed to check my email, I would have to go to one of those they call them internet cafes, although yeah, they never yeah. served coffee. It was just
right.
these cheap machines where you would like take an hour to download Hotmail.
Yeah.
and you've been traveling for a while too. And how has technology changed the traveling experience for you? Because I know you have a smartphone, and mostly when we go into another country, immediately we pick up the local signal. So how has it changed traveling itself and changed you as a writer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think my first response is that it has allowed me a closer connection to my family here, right? So closer a connection back home. So I remember about 5 years ago, I was traveling in the mountains in Turkey on a bus, and they had internet on the bus, they had Wi-Fi on the bus,
right.
And so I Skyped with my mother and my
wow.
nephew.
Oh, that's great! Yeah,
while I was traveling in a bus right. through the mountains of Turkey,
yep.
And who'd have thought, right? Because when I first started traveling, it was, you know, I would go to a country and I would buy a SIM card for my phone.
Right.
I would use cyber cafes, but now I think it has allowed me sort of a greater closer connection to right. To home
and to your community in general, and
yeah.
your community is international.
Yeah,
but
right,
like
yeah.
for example, you know, we're Facebook friends, mm-hmm. and you use Facebook as effectively as anybody I know. You land in Mexico, and mm-hmm. you know, show us the taqueria that
right.
you're eating
yeah.
at, you know, and it really kind of makes us feel. I think a lot of people. I bet a lot of people have said this to you. They say when they meet you for the first time, I really love the pictures you take when you're
right.
traveling.
Yeah. That's yeah. the first thing I think I told you, right? We get to live vicariously through your travels,
yeah.
you know. But it's fantastic that you do that. You
yeah,
know?
It's a yeah. way to share. I remember when I first started traveling, I was in Marseille, you know, which mm-hmm. is in the south of France, the largest city in the south of France, and very Arabic city, like 80% mm-hmm. people of color there. It was a beautiful experience. But I remember going into a cafe and writing a mass email to my friends mm-hmm. because that was the only way I could communicate how odd I was.
Right.
And of course, a couple of them wrote back and said, take me off this list, sir.
Yeah.
So yeah. you close the collection of stories, the book, with being back at the border.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrator says, you know, that he would rather stay in that space between mm-hmm. nations.
Yeah.
How do you, you know?
Because
it's
sometimes
you
feel that, right?
Right.
I mean, you find yourself at a point on a journey where you don't know whether to go forward or backwards.
Right.
And I think
right.
this is what happens to this particular character. This is where he suddenly found his home is no longer in a rooted place. His
right.
home is on a route, on a journey.
We have been talking to Santiago Vaquera Vasquez and talking about his new book, One Day I'll Tell You the Things I've Seen. Santiago, thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you for joining
We're
us. We're
down
yeah,
a wire.
Thanks, guys.
And I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
And make sure you join us every week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And don't forget, Santiago.
The next book you read
can save your life.
There you go.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy, a very